The Guardian.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for February the 11th. Coming up, it's a Darwin special as we welcome Cambridge philosopher Tim Lewins to the pod. He'll tell us all about the granddaddy of evolution, science and humanity. Also in the show, science writer Adam Rutherford on blogging on the origin of species. Plus, is Europe now ready to challenge America and Russia in the space race? All this and the knee brace that'll charge your mobile phone. Turning water into wine and then messing with the molecules just for the hell of it. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Well, obviously, producer Ben's been busily plonking away on his synthesizer over the weekend to come up with the audio version of the concept of science. That's our new opening bed. Give it a couple of weeks and you might love it. Love it like an elderly aunt. Here in the pod, our very own granddaddy of science, Ian Sample.
All right.
From our usual stable, it's the very unhorsey Nell Bowes from the Guardian's Arts team. I don't know who wrote that intro.
Hello.
Sorry about that. And with James Randerson away on the slopes of Switzerland, this week's anger duties fall to Adam Rutherford from Nature magazine, or dare I say it, the Nature podcast. Welcome, Adam.
Hello.
And how does it feel to be the second angriest man in science?
I really don't think I am. Well, who's the first?
James, obviously.
Are you going to fight about it?
James Angry Randerson. He is the angriest man. We'll prove it
later.
I'm
the voice of tolerance.
Our special guest this week, though, is Tim Lewins. Tim is a senior lecturer in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at Cambridge University. He's something of a Darwin wonk, and indeed he'll be giving the main lecture for this year's Darwin Day, which takes place on February the 12th and is the celebration of the great man's 199th birthday. Tim, your recent book gives a sort of philosophical introduction to Darwin and his ideas. What's Darwin got to do with philosophy? He's a natural history sort of scientist, isn't he?
That's right. So, I mean, most people think that Darwin's the guy who wrote the book about the origin of species and that he writes about climbing plants and barnacles and other such plants and animals and worms. But in fact, it turns out that, you know, Darwin had considerable philosophical interests. He wrote a lot about ethics. He wrote about politics. He thought that evolutionary ideas could be applied to the human mind, to the emotions, knowledge, and so on.
Was he a genuine polymath?
Yeah, he was. I mean, one of the things that characterises Darwin is the fact that, I mean, unlike a lot of scientists today, Darwin certainly wasn't any kind of narrow specialist. He took influences from a huge range of different areas: philosophy, anthropology, zoology, botany. Basically, you name it, Darwin had some kind of interest in it.
So tell us which philosophers and thinkers sort of influenced Darwin and also the book On the Origin of Species.
I mean, some of the philosophers that influenced Darwin are ones that we don't really know very much about today, some sort of Victorian one-hit wonders, people like James McIntosh, for example. But Darwin read a lot of David Hume. Darwin also read works by Adam Smith. I guess we tend to think of Adam Smith now as an economist, but Smith had a lot of philosophical interests as well.
And how do we see them influencing the work that Darwin did?
Well, Smith and Hume particularly very strongly influenced Darwin's approach to ethics. So one of the key things for both Smith and Hume is that ethics is basically founded on sympathy. It's founded on kind of sympathetic emotions between humans. And Darwin absolutely extends that and applies it and dovetails that kind of view with his own evolutionary understanding of how it is that that what he calls the moral sense has come to evolve in us.
One of the ideas that people might take away from the theory of natural selection is that it's a kind of a massive fight between all species, and it means that actually everything's got to be very selfish, and ethically, you know, that might raise some issues. I mean, that's a very simplistic sort of understanding of what Darwin was talking about, but how does he deal with that sort of stuff? Did he ever think about things like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I mean, no, Darwin actually sees that problem quite clearly and worries about it. So, as I said, Darwin bases his evolutionary view of morality on the idea of sympathy, and he thinks that basically we're kind of moved to act for other people because we feel their pain as though it's our own, and that gives us a kind of strong emotional motivation to help other people out. Now, Darwin says, how on earth is it that we come to have that kind of motivation? How on earth is it that we come to be sympathetic in that kind of way? And Darwin understands perfectly well that it's a problem for his theory of natural selection to explain how that might happen. Because he says, you know, if natural selection just acts on individuals, then how is it that sympathetic individuals come to exist at all? Surely sympathetic people who sacrifice themselves for others would tend to have fewer offspring, and as a result, they tend to die out in the long run. So Darwin sees quite clearly that there is this kind of problem, what we tend to call the problem of altruism.
This is something very famously taken up by Richard Dawkins in his book, The Shellfish Gene. What was Darwin's sort of conclusion to all of this?
Right, so one of the ironies here is that, of course, the thing that Dawkins wishes to assault furiously is the idea that natural selection can act at the level of groups. But it's exactly the way that Darwin tries to solve this problem, is by saying that there's a form of natural selection that exists, as Darwin puts it, at the level of the tribe, and that that kind of selection works to establish these kind of sympathetic motivations among individuals. Darwin says that maybe sympathy doesn't benefit the individual, but he says that a tribe that had a lot of sympathetic members would do much better than a tribe with few such members, basically because such tribes can be motivated in war and things like that.
Nell, you've got a question?
I'm just wondering, that's Darwin's position, you say Dawkins attacked it. Where are we at now on group selection or theories like that? What's the prevailing wind?
Right, so that's an interesting question. I think a lot of biologists, and certainly a lot of people who read popular biology, have a fairly strong impression that group selection was dead and buried sometime back in the 1960s, not so much actually with Dawkins' work, but with previous work by a guy called George Williams, who's often viewed as having kind of comprehensively kind of nailed the coffin onto the lid of group selection. It turns out that I think group selection's enjoying quite a renaissance at the moment. There was a long article published in one of the kind of more technical biological journals just a couple of months ago, in which none other than E.O. Wilson came out very strongly in favour of the efficacy of group selection. And of course, you know, E.O. Wilson can't be written off as a dodgy biologist, I don't think. So there are plenty of serious biologists now who have come to the view that group selection is a serious force. The truth is, it's, I think, very contentious. So a lot of other biologists think that, you know, Wilson's kind of misinterpreted the debate. But it's a live issue, I think, and I don't think it can be written off as being kind of obviously a waste of time to think about group selection.
How does that sort of more conceptual idea of group selection, individual selection, and so on, how does it apply to society? I mean, Darwin was obviously aware of the politics of what he was saying. He was worried that his ideas might be confused with the hard right or associated with the hard right, and he tried to distance himself from that. Why was that?
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, Darwin actually recognised very, very soon after he published The Origin of Species that people were likely to read, you know, a certain kind of sort of aggressive view into his work, the kind of thought that, you know, progress is only ever brought about by struggle, and that because of that, if we want to ensure social progress, then we better make sure that selection's allowed to run its course. We better make sure that weak members of society are allowed to perish. Darwin recognized that, and you're right that in some ways he distanced himself from it. On the other hand, people have a tendency these days to always think that, you know, Charles Darwin is on the side of the good. And a lot of people particularly try and take very great efforts to distance Darwin's views from more unsavoury forms of social Darwinism.
Are you suggesting that he probably perhaps wasn't as angelic as people make out?
I think there are all kinds of respects in which Darwin was not as angelic as people like to make out. So Darwin very clearly had serious worries that if we allowed kind of weak members of society to reproduce, then over time Darwin really did seem to worry that that society itself would grow weaker. So he shared some of the worries that later were held by eugenicists. Now, one of the ways in which Darwin importantly differs from eugenicists is that whereas eugenicists would often tend to advocate things like forced sterilization programs, Darwin thought that it was very important that we should aid the weaker members of society, even though he was concerned that that might bring about certain kinds of overall weakening of the strength of society. Darwin thought we should aid them because he thought that if we didn't do that, then what we'd be doing is basically undermining what he called the most noble part of our nature. And that's precisely the part of our nature that involves extending our sympathy towards all kinds of people, including people who are less well off.
Well, Tim, we'll pause that discussion just there and we'll come back to you a bit later in the show. Don't worry for anyone listening out there about us not tackling Darwin's religious views. We will. Producer Ben, let's have one of those brand new stings. I'm Alok Jha. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, Adam will be telling us about blogging The Origin of Species. Plus, we'll be telling how and probably why the British Navy used goats in submarine experiments. Well, it does get awfully lonely, 20,000 leagues under the sea. That, as you know, is all coming up. But first, let's get ourselves reacquainted with the rest of the science stories that have been happening this week. Here's Nell and Ian with the News Jam.
News Jack.
European Space Agency's science module Columbus has blasted into space with the hope it will end the 50-year dominance of research there by America and Russia. Almost 5 years after it was first scheduled to fly, ESA's 4.5-metre diameter Columbus module is en route to the International Space Station, 220 miles above Earth. The first experiments will take place while Atlantis is still docked and will include fixing one of Columbus's solar observatories.
A study of more than 5,000 pairs of twins has found that a child's risk of becoming overweight is mostly down to nature, not nurture. The research into children aged between 8 and 11 showed that the variation in a child's body mass index and waist circumference was 77% down to genes and 23% to the environment in which they grow up.
An e-brace which can generate electricity as you walk, creating enough power to charge mobile phones and medical devices, has been developed by scientists. The device is inspired by technology used in hybrid cars, which store the power from braking to generate electricity. In tests, volunteers generated 5 watts of power when they wore a brace on each leg. The researchers said it was enough to operate a portable GPS navigation unit, a robotic prosthetic joint, or a heart pacemaker.
And finally, it's been revealed that the Royal Navy used goats to test whether it was safe for sailors to escape from stricken submarines. They used goat skulls because they are similar shaped to those of humans. Officials from the Ministry of Defence admit that the practice of employing live goats to investigate the effects of the bends has been going on for decades.
Nell and Ian, thanks for all those. Let's talk a bit more about some of those stories. Ian, take us through the saga of the shuttle. It's been delayed several times already. The Columbus module is a European venture. Why is it so important for the Europeans to have something up on the International Space Station?
This is Europe's own real estate in space, as they call it, and it really breaks sort of 25 years of Europeans just catching lifts up to the ISS, the space station. Now with Columbus up there, this is Europe's science module. We actually earn new seats on the shuttle, so we can send up more people. There'll be more people up there doing research. So it's really a new time for a bit of a turning point for Europe. Really, up until now, it's been almost exclusively Americans and Russians. I mean, the Europeans have been going up, but they have to sort of squeeze these rides in. So it'll really change the sort of the political power up there, if you like. Europe has a much stronger voice up there than it has had before.
The shuttle was supposed to go up actually in December last year. It didn't, and it's been delayed again for a couple of months now. What was the problem?
They've had this nightmare problem since the first flights after Columbia. Columbia destroyed, actually, in 2003. And it was always with fuel sensors, that they had a few fuel sensors on the main tank. And the idea is that it's basically a safety system that when the shuttle gets into orbit, these sensors are designed to make sure that the engines don't keep running when the fuels run out. Because if that happens, the engine will just melt down and the whole thing probably blow up. So it was really crucial to have these sensors working properly. And they're broken. They had 3, and it's a voting system. If 2 say, yeah, everything's okay, then it keeps flying. And it's quite a complex sort of safety system. They couldn't get it right, and it was just kept going wrong every time they fueled the shuttle up. So they've managed to get a fix, and luckily got the what seems to be a pretty clean launch up the other day, despite the bad weather conditions. They've got a lot more to do, though. They've got 13 more flights to fit in by 2010 now.
When it gets decommissioned, the shuttle gets decommissioned to be replaced by the Crew Exploration Vehicle, yeah, which isn't even built yet. So what kind of stuff are we going to be able to do on Columbus, or astronauts, rather?
Well, they've got 3 labs inside, basically, and 3 on the outside. So there's 2 sort of external modules, if you like. The ones inside, they'll be looking at weird things, like how plants grow. How do seeds know which way's up? Does gravity make their roots go curly? And all sorts of bizarre plant physiology. They're also going to be doing an awful lot of tests on the people up there, the astronauts, in a physiology lab. And this will be taking blood samples, looking at how their immune system is affected, if it's affected at all by the radiation environment up there. But they're also doing things like strapping bits of material onto the side of the lab, exposing them to the sort of conditions of space, seeing how those materials are damaged over time, and they might play into sort of new materials you'd use to make spaceships in the future. They're also exposing some sort of fungal spores and some lichen on the outside, just to see if these ideas of sort of panspermia, sort of Fred Hoyle kind of ideas, you know, would have anything remotely in them, and just looking at how hardy
these they're going up into space in a multi-billion-dollar sort of ship to just do agriculture and gardening, basically.
Yeah, and an awful lot of fluid mechanics, which I'm not going to talk about.
Let's move away from fluid mechanics to knee braces and phone charging. This is quite an interesting story. A story described in Science magazine: a knee brace that can generate about 5 watts of electricity as you walk quite leisurely at 2.5 miles an hour, and if you run, you can generate something like 50 watts, which is not bad at all. The question I have for the pod is: would you wear this?
Well, it's a bit disconcerting that one of the applications they suggest for their own devices to power a heart pacemaker.
Yes, and if you stop walking, it stops working. So it's good for exercise purposes, no?
But keep running.
Ian, you could use it to power your prosthetic arm.
Looking for an application.
No, you could use it to your prosthetic arm.
My prosthetic arm.
Yeah, what did you think I said, Adam?
5 watts, is that enough to power a mobile phone or an iPod, right?
It's plenty.
But it's not planned for commercial use, is it? It's planned for people who need to wear knee braces, I believe.
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, you could use it, they said soldiers could use it to power exoskeletal type things to help them lift things.
But that's just not true, because that's just
not true.
It's not true because you're not going to be creating energy, are you?
Does it get harder and harder to walk as you get
No, 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 no. They looked at how much energy it only takes 1 watt of sort of energy you expend to create 1 watt of, or pretty much 1 watt.
Shut up.
You know, of course, we're not breaking the laws of thermodynamics here, but ultimately, you do have to wear 2, obviously. And then it's very useful. I can't believe you're all dissing
it.
What
would you use yours for, apart from your pod thing?
Well, you know, I'll just have power on the move wherever I am. That'd be brilliant.
For
my iPod. Charging up your laptop battery.
My battery. I'll be able to walk and type at the same time. And get Nell, before we get silly, let's talk about goats.
Oh, yeah, and we mustn't be silly about goats.
No.
No, absolutely, yeah.
I think you need to tell me what the MOD were up to.
The thing about getting depressurised very quickly is that you get something called the bends, which is quite difficult to study, and they've obviously been using goats to do it. They put out the hilarious statement, sorry, I shouldn't take this too cheekily, but saying they were never placed underwater and they were not alone. Other goats were in there too, of the pressure chamber in which they did the experiments.
How many goats got killed?
Six. Six goats killed in 400 experiments over the past 6 years, plus another 120 kind of humanely killed after the experiment.
And the thing that I thought was interesting in your report was that they use goats because their heads are the same size and shape as humans.
See, I didn't know
near
that.
Enough.
How
I didn't
is
know
a
that.
Goat's head the same shape as a human's?
Yours looks like the same shape as a human's as a goat's, I have to say.
It's better than mice, put it that way.
Yeah, I'm sure the sailors didn't complain about the extra company anyway. Let's wrap that up there. In fact, it's been pointed out that I always say let's wrap that up there, so actually let's park that there, shall we? Remember, if you want to contribute to any of these topics, post a comment on the Facebook wall or head to the Science blog. That's blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. Now, we'll move back to the subject of Charles Darwin, more specifically his book On the Origin of Species. If you bought last Saturday's Guardian, you'll have been no doubt delighted to see some extracts from Darwin's masterwork. Accompanying our Darwin supplement were essays from Richard Dawkins, geneticist Lawrence Hurst, and the former Bishop of Oxford, Richard Harris. If you missed the paper, you can see everything at guardian.co.uk/science/Darwin. But there's more. Adam Rutherford from Nature's been here in the pod all this time. Adam, you're going to do something on the Guardian website, which is quite interesting, with Origin of Species. Tell us what you're up to.
Right, so Comment is free. The Guardian's online blogging site has been running a series of articles called Blogging the Quran, where a writer is reading the Quran from beginning to end and writing about its significance, its contemporary significance. And that in itself was inspired by another set of articles called Blogging the Bible, which was done in Slate magazine last year. And when I was reading this, it's very interesting. I don't know much about Islam, but it occurred to me that I haven't read The Origin of Species since I was an undergraduate. I did evolutionary biology 10 or 12 years ago. But in that time, I've been talking about it and writing about it and defending it quite passionately, without actually having opened it. So I thought, well, you know, now is the time for me to revisit this and actually read it from beginning to end and write about what it means now and how it feels to read.
So your first post is going to be published in a week or so. Tell us what that's going to cover.
The first piece is just an introduction to why I'm doing this and talking a little bit about the Blogging the Quran. I've attempted not to set this up as a conflict with religion, but inevitably, that does come out of it. The Bible and the Quran are the sources of all that oppose the teaching of evolution. And so Darwin doesn't make any comment about religion throughout almost all of The Origin of Species. But nevertheless, One of the things that I've been looking at is the standard attacks on the theory of evolution that creationists make, including the intelligent design lobby, and why almost all of them are dealt really quite comprehensively in the original text, and we haven't had to wait 150 years to answer those arguments.
We can't talk about evolution without mentioning intelligent design, as hateful as it is as a thing. Give us an example of how Darwin tackled intelligent design before it was even called that. Creationism, if you like.
So the intelligent design lobby, led by this guy Michael Behe, they talk about this concept called irreducible complexity, as I know that James has talked about on this show many times before. Now, it's complete bollocks. It's a complete sham. And the best way that I think you can explain it, the concept of irreducible complexity, is by saying, just because you don't understand something doesn't mean that
so
I
tell
don't.
Tell us just quickly what irreducible complexity is.
The concept is that something that cannot be explained by using the rules of natural selection therefore invokes the concept of a designer. Right? The two examples they always give are the flagella on bacteria and the eye. There are others, but they, as has been discussed and refuted millions of times by smarter people than the intelligent design lobby, all of the aspects of that irreducible complexity are easily explicable, and Darwin actually does talk about the eye in some detail.
The interesting thing is, of course, that in the 150 years since the theory of natural selection has been published, all the scientific theories that have come along since then have just gone on to prove in this area, I mean, all the scientific theories in this area have gone on to just prove him more and more correct, which is quite an incredible testament to his idea. Nell, you've got a question.
I was just wondering how he compares to modern popular science in terms of style.
It's a really interesting question because it's very Victorian. I can't deny that there are sections.
Is it hard to read?
It is quite hard to read. There are bits which are really quite dense. There's a number of factors playing in here, which is that he references a lot of people, right? And in academic scientific papers, you do put references in. But this was a popular science book in the 19th century. And one of the reasons he references so many people is because he came back from the voyage of the Beagle and some of his notes weren't that good. And then he spent the next 30 years filling in loads of those gaps. And he did that by writing. He was a man of letters. He wrote thousands and thousands of letters. And he wrote to other crewmen from the Beagle to check his notes. And he wrote to, you know, hundreds of botanists and geologists from that era. And that's how he came up with the theory of evolution. So it is quite dense, but the key thing is that you really take home is that it's just right and there's nothing in there that feels particularly wrong.
Tim, you've got a question.
It's not really a question, actually. I have an assertion.
Please assert away.
I mean, it's true that in some ways the book is dense. It's meant to be an abstract of a book that would have been even bigger.
The Big
and
Book of Species.
Even when you read The Origin, Darwin bashes you over the head with a huge number of facts, basically, which are intended to be in support of his theory. So, you know, in that sense, it's difficult to get your head around. On the other hand, when you compare it with other kind of equally foundational works of science, it's incredibly accessible. I mean, so, you know, anyone can pick up The Origin of Species and have a pretty good understanding of what's going on. You can't necessarily say that for original work by the likes of Einstein, for example.
So in that respect, Principia is a really good example of something really difficult to read.
Latin.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And I think that you know, his writing style is very much of its time. Having said that, his conclusion, the recap at the end, is just eminently readable. And if I know a lot of people haven't read The Origin of Species, looking around this table.
Oh, I've read the odd chapter.
Nell has, Alec hasn't, Ian.
No, I don't think I will either.
Well, I suggest that you do read the recap because it's really easy to read and it's beautifully written.
Very good, everyone. Well, you can follow Adam's progress at commentisfree.guardian.co.uk. Well, we've had some very positive comments from you lot in response to last week's show with Marcus de Sotoy. Andrew Richardson kindly pointed out,
science was never meant to be funny, but the elephant shrew pronunciation contest and the question about Sudoku at the end were hilarious.
Actually, yeah, Nell, can you do that elephant shrew again? Do you remember? You don't, do you?
Rinkakayan, I think.
Oh, God.
Utsung Ventsis.
William Elwood posted with,
great episode this week. It must have been the fact that I've been up far too long on not a lot of sleep hacking away on my final year project. But can we have some love for church and cheering at some point?
Well, maybe. By the way, this show always sounds better after a bout of sleep deprivation. And finally, on the subject of last week's Thought for the Pod, which was Jim Al-Khalili's pontification of the golden age of Arabic science, Jim E. wrote...
Beautifully put, science is science. There can't be any such thing as Muslim science.
Now, Adam, our Thought for the Pod is a bit more of a sore point for you lot of nature, isn't it? Tell us more.
Oh, no, we're very, very gracious about it.
Are you? Well, what's your version of our Thought for the Pod called?
Our version, which we launched about 4 months before you introduced Thought for the Pod, is called the Podium.
Is it as interesting as ours, though?
Podium, I get it. It's nice.
Podium, we spell it with capital letters.
Italicised.
Yeah.
Works on paper. I'm not sure about radio, but, you know. Whatever. Whatever. Okay,
You'll be hearing from our lawyers.
Before we wrap up this week, we're going to get some final words from our special guest, Tim Lewins. Tim, we had a show a few weeks ago where we had the editor of the New Humanist magazine, Caspar Melville. He talked to us about an article in his newsletter about a fictional dinner party with Charles Darwin, where he brought together people and got them to ask Darwin questions that they've always wanted to ask him. If you had Charles Darwin in front of you now, what would you ask him? What do you want to know from him?
Heavens. You've sprung that one.
Are there any heavens? Maybe that's what you want to know.
Or what you'd want to tell him over the last 150 years.
I want to tell you something. James Randerson, our very own science correspondent, wanted to show him Star Wars because he figured that he's going to need some time to relax after all he's learning. And Steve Jones, the evolutionary biologist, said that he would talk to him about genetics and DNA as a way of proving his theory. You know, he was a bit modest, as you say, Adam, about his ideas in the book. And this idea that 100 years later... a lot of science has just proved him correct.
Yeah, I think I'd be interested to see what he makes of institutions like Darwin Day, actually. I mean, it's odd that, you know, we celebrate Darwin's birthday, or at least some people celebrate Darwin's birthday. And Darwin is kind of the patron saint of the new atheists, really. And I think I'd be intrigued to know how comfortable Darwin would be in that position.
Darwin himself wasn't an atheist. He even trained to be a vicar at one point, didn't he? And he was friends with his local clergy. In your lecture, are you going to go into the religion side of things?
I'll be talking a little bit about Darwin and religion, yeah. I mean, Darwin's views about religion are interesting, and they don't sit very easily in the modern pigeonholing that we have. And one of the problems, I think, in the debate about science and religion today is that there are two very shrill views. One is the intelligent design view. The other is the kind of the new atheist view, the view that says that, you know, evolution has comprehensively disposed of religion, and anyone who's a Christian or indeed subscribes to any kind of religion is a moron. Right? I mean, those are basically the two kind of most prominent views these days. And Darwin doesn't agree with either of those views. So I'll be trying to talk a little bit about that and talk a little bit about the ways in which Darwin's views on religion changed over the course of his life, the ways in which, for example, you know, Darwin certainly rejects the standard argument from design. He's opposed to the kind of views that are now espoused by intelligent design theorists. But on the other hand, Darwin really shies away from calling himself an atheist. So you can't really easily assimilate Darwin either to the sort of Dawkins view or to the intelligent design view either.
Adam, it's fair to call you a new atheist. You're one of the more prolific atheist bloggers on Comment is Free with your 1,000 comment posts. Well done, by the way. What do you make of Darwin and religion? And you specifically said earlier that you're doing this sort of in response to blogging the Quran, but you don't want this to be about a war between religion and evolution. Why not?
Well, you know, the first thing is, like, I don't consider myself to be a new atheist. I've always been an atheist, and atheists have been around.
You're an old atheist.
A lot longer than Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris or those guys. I also don't think that I'm a particularly militant atheist. I, if you read some of the pieces I've read, they're actually fairly tolerant. And I call for more tolerance and more conversation between the religious and the atheist. What I despise is fundamentalism, and Christian and Muslim fundamentalism, and intelligent design is a manifestation of that creationism, is hateful and anti-science and anti-humanist. And so, you know, that's a cause which is worth fighting for. Now, I don't think that the theory of evolution and science in general is incompatible with having a liberal view of Christianity or religion in general. I think it's fine, and I believe that Bishop Harries discusses that very concept in your supplement. The problem is, for me, I'm not responding directly to blogging the Quran or blogging the Bible. The problem is that the arguments used by creationists and by fundamentalists attack the premise of the origin of species, and they say that it's wrong. Now, they're easy arguments to refute, but what I've tried to do is to revert back to the original text in order to deal with these. I think that people need to be equipped with answers to those fairly prosaic arguments.
Well, Richard Harries, as you mentioned, has written a piece in the Darwin Supplement. It's very interesting. He talks about how the origin of species was how it was seen by Christians in the 19th century, and essentially comes to the conclusion that natural selection has no problem with faith and vice versa. It's that actually some of its implications possibly are a bit un-Christian, things like the wastefulness of nature and that kind of thing, which people might have problems with. Tim, I'm going to leave the last word to you. You're giving the lecture, as we've said, on Darwin Day, on his 199th birthday. What do you want people to sort of take away from it? The people who are listening to the lecture, what do you want people to take away from it? And why do you think that talking about Darwin is still important today?
In some ways, I think Darwin's a good counterpoint to these very same kind of noisy voices that we hear all the time talking about what the implications are of an evolutionary view. Darwin, in a lot of ways, I want to persuade people, isn't a Darwinian, actually. Darwin thinks that natural selection is important, but he doesn't always think it's the most important force. Darwin certainly thinks that evolution has religious implications, but he doesn't think it straightforwardly disposes of all kinds of religious views. And he certainly thinks that there's room left over for a certain kind of faith. Now, personally, I don't want to endorse that view. I'm as much of an atheist as Richard Dawkins, I suspect. But I do think that a lot of what Darwin says helps to show that the debate is more complicated and, if anything, just more interesting, I think, than a lot of people have made it out to be. And that's true both when we talk about ethics, when we talk about religion, when we talk about politics, when we talk about knowledge, you name it. I think Darwin has something interesting to say.
Adam?
The one thing that I've got out of rereading The Origin in the last couple of weeks is that it's such a good work of science. It doesn't make, and specifically The Origin of Species, doesn't make many comments on things outside of science. And it's just a really good, hard-working, humble piece of good research. And that's what I think is most important about this Darwin Day.
Well, that's us done for another week. My thanks to everyone in the pod, Nell Bowes, Ian Sample, Adam Rutherford, and our special guest, Tim Lewins. He'll be giving the Darwin Day lecture at University College London on Tuesday, February the 12th. It's sold out, but why don't you see if you can get some touted tickets anyway. To comment on anything you've heard in the show, including our new music, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or leave a comment on the Facebook wall. Remember also, you can check out the rest of The Guardian's podcasts on their shiny new homepage, guardian.co.uk/audio. Next week, we'll be podding live-ish at the AAAS conference in Boston. It's going to be historic. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green, and if you want him to bring you back an iPod for cheap, he's prepared to take the risk through customs. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Guardian.co.uk